Class is now in session. And the UPS store is here to help you ace arriving on campus. Our certified packing experts can pack everything you need, from desktops to decor. Plus, when you pack and ship with us, you get our exclusive pack and ship guarantee. Your items arrive safe or your money back. Restrictions and limitations apply. To get a 20% off packing coupon and for full details, visit theupsstore.com/packing.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Gemma Sharp and Alicia Rantower. Gemma is an Associate Professor of Research and Senior Clinical Psychologist who leads the Body Image and Eating Disorder Research Programme at Monash University in Melbourne. Gemma is also the lead of the International Consortium for Research in Eating Disorders, which will be officially launched in September 2024. Alicia is a Research Officer at the Body Image and Eating Disorder Research Group at Monash University in Melbourne and an aspiring clinical psychologist. This week, we talk all about the menopause programme that Gemma and Alicia have put together to support women going through the menopause who develop symptoms of eating disorders and disordered eating. The menopause can be a time where so much change happens, and for those who have had an eating disorder, it poses a particular risk, but also for people that haven't had an eating disorder before, it can cause lots of changes to your body and your mood, which can be a susceptible time for developing an eating disorder.
Thank you both so much for joining me on the podcast. Gemma, it's so lovely to have you back. And obviously, Alicia, it's really nice to have you on the podcast. I love the fact that, Gemma, you're just bringing kind of, you know, yourself back, but also, you know, bringing new people. It's great because my guest list just keeps expanding from you. It's wonderful.
Oh, you can always rely on me to expand a guest list. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
To start, do you both want to introduce yourselves?
I can go first. So I'm Gemma Sharp. I'm an associate professor at Monash University, and I'm lucky enough to lead the Body Image and Eating Disorders Research Program there at Monash. And I'm also lucky enough to be the leader of the International Consortium for Research in Eating Disorders, CORE-ED. And it's a great pleasure to be here.
And I'm Alicia Rantower. I am a research officer working with Gemma at the Eating Disorder and Body Image Research Group at Monash. So yes, I have been studying psychology. I'm an aspiring clinical psychologist, and yeah, it's been wonderful to be under Gemma's wing and learning about all this.
Amazing. Oh, well, brilliant introductions from both of you. I feel very flattered to have you on the podcast. And I mean, even more flattered the fact that you're halfway across the globe. I mean, the fact that you've even heard of Full of Beans is amazing. So yeah, thank you so much. And the stuff that we're going to talk about today, actually, I'm really, really interested to talk about with you because I guess from a few different angles, like, my mum has been through the menopause and is going through the menopause, and a lot of things have come up for her that maybe were kind of underlying things before, but then now the menopause has kind of like blown it all up, which I think is quite interesting. And I know that also things like neurodiversity, there's a lot more research coming out that kind of those kind of characteristics are elevated by the menopause. So yes, to start with, did you want to explain a little bit about the link between menopause and eating disorders?
So just like puberty, which is a time of great hormonal change, we know that menopause is also a risk period for either the onset or exacerbation of pre-existing eating disorders. So with menopause, it's the cessation of reproductive functioning. So we're losing estrogen, we're losing progesterone. That has a huge impact on women's brains and bodies. And we found that hormonal cycling, particularly in the last phases just before menopause, which we call perimenopause, can be a big risk time for binge eating episodes, body dissatisfaction, the things we consider associated with quite a few different types of eating disorders. So we're not sure of the exact mechanisms yet, but I suppose just like younger women notice probably some differences in their eating disorder symptoms around their menstrual cycles, we'll imagine that on steroids, basically. Yeah. That's what's happening in menopause. We do need to do a lot more research in this space because we're not 100% sure of all these mechanisms, as I said, but just like puberty, it is a risk period. And I think that's a biological side, but there are other aspects as well. I think just with the end of reproductive functioning, women can start to view themselves very differently. They're like, hey, what's my role in life now? What's the rest of life hold for me? And so there's this kind of shift in identity as well. And we know that when people are questioning their identities, going through transition phases, that's when an eating disorder can unfortunately jump in. It finds a space in your brain and it takes hold sometimes. So that's, I suppose, another part, kind of the socio-cultural environment in which women find themselves, never mind the huge biological changes which they're undergoing as well.
I think that's such an interesting point, and that's actually something I'd not considered myself before, was that if you think about when you're on your period, and I guess the mood adjustments, but also the kind of cravings that you get and things like that, to have that consistently when you're going through perimenopause or menopause, like, that's, I can imagine, quite scary. And I think, you know, not to keep going back to my mum, but she is obviously the person that I've witnessed go through it, and I think for her that identity piece was such a big thing, in that she'd kind of gone from being this, like, a powerhouse of a woman, like a very successful businesswoman, and she still is, but then all of a sudden, like, forgetting things, or, you know, not being able to put words together in that sense. And I think that idea of identity is so important, and especially in a world where, like you're saying, there's a lot of pressure on women to look a certain way, and then all of a sudden they've got all these hormonal changes, which means that they can't maybe have the body that they used to have, and things are changing that are completely out of their control, which, like you say, is a perfect time for an eating disorder to pop up and be like, I can provide the answer to you, when everything else feels very chaotic.
Absolutely. Thanks for sharing that about your mum there, Hannah, and that is quite a common occurrence, like you're saying, those kind of cognitive or thought issues, like issues with memory, issues with putting sentences together, sort of what's happening to me, the confusion. And that's, yeah, it can be debilitating for some women. Some women don't have so many symptoms, but for others, it absolutely does mess with their heads, to put it boldly. Yeah. And they're like, well, is this the rest of my life? Am I going to continue like this forever? And that's a really tricky thing. So I suppose that's why we're so motivated to educate women about what to expect and how to get support for such experiences.
Yeah. And I'd love if you knew a bit more about it. You know, you mentioned the hormonal changes, and you mentioned estrogen and progesterone. What specifically is their role, and then what is the impact of them changing in a woman's body?
So in particular with estrogen, like, I think people may have this misconception that it only operates below the belt, to put it crudely, like, it's doing that, you know, egg cycling, et cetera. But estrogen actually has really protective effects on the brain. So when we lose estrogen, it means that our mood drops, and also impacts our thoughts and reasoning too. And that's why I suppose some people feel a bit out of control a bit with their period cycling at some phases. So low estrogen is not a wonderful place to be for some people, and I suppose that's why we're so keen on hormone replacement therapy, so that we can give women back that protective estrogen effect. Obviously, sexual functioning as well. Like, we know that during menopause, women can experience vaginal dryness and sexual discomfort. And again, that's those hormones playing a role in allowing women to have a satisfying sexual life. So they're just so important all around the body. It's not just reproductive functioning, it's brain functioning, it's mood regulation, it's all of it.
Yeah. And I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that your levels of testosterone change, which I think people are always surprised by, because when people think of testosterone, they just think male hormone. But am I correct in that? And does that have an impact?
Another great question, Hannah. And yes, testosterone does tend to decline, not as radically as estrogen and progesterone. So as you mentioned, we all have testosterone. It's not just the remit of cisgender males. And testosterone is actually quite helpful for, you know, building our muscles, our sex drive, things like that. So women may notice that their libido drops around the time of menopause because they're just experiencing that testosterone drop. And there has been quite a surge of interest in testosterone therapy as well, as a result of people becoming more aware of that drop.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting, and please do excuse me for all the hormone questions. As a biomedical student, it's the thing that interests me the most.
Go for it.
But I had another question, and I don't know whether this is just my brain putting things together or not, and I don't actually know the impact of hormones specifically, but I was just thinking then when you were saying about like the changes in hormones, I think you mentioned at the start that the eating disorders that you've kind of seen more commonly in research is like binge eating disorder like symptoms, but obviously like even within that binge eating disorder, there's a lot of restriction that goes on, and then there's obviously the binging. I just wondered, does the impact of restriction have an impact on estrogen levels? So if somebody's engaging in restrictive behaviours, let's say things that would be more associated with anorexia, you know, an attempt to lose weight, is that then going to negatively impact estrogen levels and then have a worse consequence on the symptoms of menopause?
Definitely, Hannah. You know, where there is restriction, of course, we know that some people with eating disorders may lose their periods, and they're definitely going to see lower estrogen as well. And it leads to really similar symptoms because they're going through similar things to what women in menopause are going through. And yeah, it can be really confusing then for women in menopause who have previously had eating disorders or have ongoing ones, because the symptoms can be super similar because hormones are doing really similar things.
Yeah. And I think that there would be the difficulty there of I don't want this to say how sound has been sound, but it's like I've engaged in these behaviours. If you've had an eating disorder for a long time or had an eating disorder previously, I've engaged in these behaviours before with restriction and they've worked, quote unquote worked, and then all of a sudden you're in menopause and those behaviours aren't working for you anymore. You know, I know that for my mum, thank God she put up her dieting hat quite a few years ago, and she, whilst it's been difficult embracing her new body, she has embraced her new body in it, and it's been really refreshing to see. But I can imagine for a lot of women, it's like, I don't want to embrace this new body. You know, things do kind of shift around and you see more kind of weight gain around the stomach, which can be a really difficult area for people. And I know, Gemma, that you mentioned at the start, like body image concerns being something that you saw quite a lot. And I wondered maybe if we could chat more about that, of when you were speaking to women that experienced the menopause, how their body image has been affected by that transition.
Absolutely. And thanks for the question, Hannah. And I think even people who aren't experiencing eating disorders or disordered eating, their body image may take a hit in this menopausal transition because there is a difference in fat distribution around the body, which is absolutely as a result of those hormonal fluctuations. And as you said, it's more sort of less bottoms and thighs. It moves more to the abdominal area. And you're right. I'm so glad that your mum embraced it, but not everyone does. And I'm just thinking about some of our lived experience workshops, and people were saying, oh, I don't want to look like an egg. So they were using that analogy of an egg body and saying, well, I'm just going to try harder at my eating disorder, quote unquote, to make sure I don't end up like that. So I think it is a huge challenge for women in midlife to embrace a new body. And we did end up including this in our educational package because of there were so many requests. It's like, well, you know, we've got the eating sort of behaviors, but what about what I think of myself? And we realized that a lot of the body image content was very youth focused. And that's a shame. Like, obviously, body image concerns can happen at any time in life. So so we ended up doing a bit of a literature search, Alicia and I. Okay, what are the resources for women in midlife? We came up with some, but there's still a lot more work to do. And I think kind of like what your mum was doing there, embracing her experience that got her to that point, that my body allowed me to get to this age, I can still do X, Y, Z. So it was more of a, I suppose, body appreciation or body neutrality approach rather than body positivity. We found that kind of a bit of a hard sell in a midlife group, particularly with coping with all of those bodily changes.
Yeah, I think that is my kind of stance across the board in terms of body image is, you know, you're not, let's be realistic, going to wake up every day and think, hot diggity damn, I look amazing today. But you probably could wake up most days and, you know, look in the mirror and say, okay, this is us, that's okay. I think that's a much more kind of maintainable approach to body image. And, you know, some days you may look in the mirror and think, wow, that's amazing. That's my body and I look incredible today. And that's fantastic when those days do occur. But I think also not holding your identity around your body image, because I think that can be a dangerous place when the way that you look, you know, that impacts how you feel about yourself as an overall individual, which is really difficult. And I wonder if you kind of had any tips there for people that are going through the menopause and their body is changing. Because it's such a scary place, and you know, to reach body neutrality is great, but I think it's a long journey to be able to reach that. And when everything's changing consistently, I think the thing that, you know, which aligns with eating disorder recovery and has been my experience in my recent weight restoration is like, okay, things are changing and they're completely out of my control, and I also don't know when it's going to stop. And I think that's the scary thing of, like, you know, you adjust to the body and then all of a sudden it's like, actually, no, we're not quite done. We're just going to tweak this bit. Or, you know, you need to gain a bit more weight there and you have no control over where you're going to gain that weight. So did you have any thoughts around kind of how people can navigate that day to day whilst they're in the menopause?
A great question, Hannah, and I think it's probably $1 million one, and I'm sure we'll come up with something brilliant together in this podcast. So I think one of the first things we did was really just because women didn't understand what was going on in perimenopause and menopause, and there are educational sources. So that's what we wanted to tell them. It was like, actually, this is what's going on for you, because I think a lot of the distress comes from the uncertainty. So just some basic education is a good place to start. And then what we were also really looking at was just going, well, what can we do to help with the distress around menopause? So that's, I suppose, more of those psychological supports if people do want to seek more formalized support, but also actual medications, medical options as well, like hormone replacement therapy, options like that. There are more therapeutic options than people realize. You don't have to suffer through menopause. Just like we, you know, you need a multidisciplinary treatment team for an eating disorder, menopause is exactly the same. You need those women's health experts like endocrinologists, gynecologists, your general practitioner in there supporting you with all these different aspects. So as much as There is some acceptance required of bodily changes. There's also seeking support for all the different symptoms you're experiencing too, because you can imagine if you're experiencing insomnia because of hot flushes, you feel like your memory's failing you and you're like, oh, my body's just gone to pot, for want of a better term. I think there are ways and means of helping women with all of these different issues together, and it's about having a good care team around you.
Yeah, I think you're so right, and I think it's that element of, again, and I know that not every woman is kind of, you know, the powerful woman, but that's kind of the person that I think too that maybe would, maybe I'm wrong, but would struggle the most with the menopause, because it's kind of, everything's changing so much and out of your control, whereas you're used to kind of being in control and things like that. And I think one thing that I've heard a lot of women say is that they're very worried about things like HRT because of the research, you know, around maybe the consequences and the health things that can come up for that. And I wondered maybe if we could explore that a little bit more, whether you did any research around HRT and the kind of negative side effects, I guess, but then also to think about, you know, the different treatment options that might be available to people, because I assume HRT is not going to work for everybody either. And I think that's maybe something that gets people down as well, is, oh, well, HRT is the only thing I can do, but it's not working for me. So I'm at a loss.
And great question there, Hannah. And I'm going to let Alicia answer part of this as well, of course. I just wanted to pick up on, like, I think it's such an interesting question. You're saying that women are seeing themselves as powerful, then they're hitting menopause and suddenly they lose their power. But I wonder if part of our work is to reconceptualize menopause as an opportunity or a chance to actually be more powerful, or take on a new aspect of identity that you couldn't do beforehand. I mean, you can throw out those pads and tampons, ladies. You can, you know, maybe there are actual opportunities here. So I think, and I think the women who do best through it are like, oh, now I can, like, maybe I've raised my children. Maybe I go back to study. Maybe I go on that holiday I've always wanted to go on. Like, just, yeah, there are opportunities here, absolutely, and we can shift that self-identity. And just going back to your other question about HRT, you're absolutely right. And I think, unfortunately, HRT got some really bad press about 20 years ago, where there was this spurious research that linked it with breast cancer. And that has subsequently been debunked. So I suppose a lot of our good colleagues who are endocrinologists, gynecologists, spend a lot of their time just educating women about, no, actually, you can take this. You do not need to be afraid. But as you said, not everyone wants to take hormones, and that's okay too. Not everyone... yeah, people sort of view it as a little bit unnatural, I think, in some instances. So we do need options for people that are non-hormonal based.
I really like what you're saying there about the opportunities that can arise, because I think not to be funny, but periods are really friggin' annoying, and they roll around like every 3 to 4 weeks, and it's like, oh my god, I just got over this, I don't want this again. Exactly. And to be able to kind of have that next stage of life, like you say, and, you know, I'm rambling on about my mum because she is my hero in life, but she has absolutely done that. You know, she's started a new business, and she now coaches people and supports them with their business, and she's traveling like it's nobody's business. They're currently, you know, walking around Wales, and it's just, you know, I think it's having that acceptance of, okay, things have changed. I maybe look different, my life looks different, but different isn't necessarily bad, which I think is a hard thing to come by. And, you know, I hate change. I'm literally the worst person at change in the world, and I will avoid it at all costs. But unfortunately, it does happen. And I think the resistance to change makes change so much worse. So if you can embrace it sooner, as hard as it is, you then can see, you know, what's on the other side of this. Like, what other things are available to me now? which I think is really exciting. You can take it as an exciting thing rather than maybe the scariness.
Exactly. I'm almost with you for that medication. Sorry, Hannah.
No worries.
It's not the easiest to say. We can put it in the show notes. Yeah, all good. It's actually fezolinetant, and it's a non-hormonal medication that that helps with menopausal symptoms because there was that demand for non-hormonal pharmacological therapy. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure if it's not available in Australia yet, it will be soon and surely around the world. But I think what we also know is that psychological therapy can be helpful for managing certain symptoms of menopause, like hot flushes, etc. Even things like hypnosis can be helpful. Cool. So as we're building up the evidence of options for women seeking menopause-related support, I think that will hearten a lot of people. So I think obviously we need more research here, but there are options, and people just need to ask their doctors or women's health specialists to seek them out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so interesting that psychological help could help with hot flushes. That's really interesting. I would have thought that that was much more of a biological thing that you can't really control with that sort of therapy. I don't know, am I being silly there?
No, you asked such a good question, and I suppose whenever I'm sort of helping someone with, say, like chronic pain, for example, so like it's our response to these symptoms, so you're not necessarily alleviating them, you're reducing the distress around experiencing them. Yeah. And just like with pain, it's our response to pain, because I suppose two people can have the same injury and have very different experiences. Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, obviously we're a bit biased. You're two speakers today with our backgrounds in psychology, but it can certainly be helpful in that respect too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's really interesting. And I guess talking about kind of the psychology behind things and that, I really wanted to talk to you about your research that you've been doing. And I wondered kind of what was the motivation behind starting this program for when you started your research?
So I suppose it's been in the works a little while, like any research. Like, we have these ideas well before the funding comes through to actually execute it. But I think I was working with people who are sort of in that perimenopause, menopause space in my private clinic. And I was just going, there is absolutely nothing out there for them in terms of education. And even their GPs would sort of be quite focused on their eating disorder, because they'd been treating them with their eating disorder for potentially decades previously. And it's like, no, I think something different is going on in my body. And unfortunately, sometimes that was being dismissed. And I think I was one of the few people who was validating them, going, no, this could be perimenopause. And we'd do questionnaires, I'd ask them more questions, and it did seem like it could be. But because of the eating disorder complication in there, it was a little bit trickier than if someone hadn't experienced an eating disorder. But they just knew in themselves that something wasn't right. They knew, like, they knew what their eating disorder looked like, sort of. But they're going, no, this is different. And I'm like, yeah, I believe you. I believe something is going on in your body that's not what normally happens for you. And then, as I mentioned, looking online, I was just going, well, where do I direct people to read more about this? And sort of a smattering of research papers that aren't sort of the most reader friendly, as I'm sure all of us would agree. So I think that's where it came from, just knowing that there wasn't much out there, and that education needed to play such a crucial role in just validating women's experiences in midlife.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really interested there what you were saying. I think I picked up on it correctly, in that, you know, people, the symptoms people are experiencing, you were like, oh, this is probably like maybe the onset of menopause. I'm interested to hear what the difference is between the symptoms people experience in perimenopause and menopause, but then also how you established, okay, this is something more than an eating disorder, those eating disorder symptoms, because I think that that could be a completely entangled mess of, I don't know, what's perimenopause, what's an eating disorder, and how you then establish what was what.
Great question, Hannah. I'm going to throw to Alicia, who made our sort of diagram of those intersections for the resource.
Ooh, amazing.
Great question, Han. And I think all of the participants that we have spoken to in our research came asking the same question, like in terms of differentiating between symptoms of menopause and symptoms of eating disorders. It is such a struggle. And yeah, we need more work here. People need help, definitely from us reviewing literature, from talking to people with lived experience. As we were talking about before, hormones are doing similar things. So they are experiencing really similar symptoms. And a lot of the time they couldn't distinguish, they couldn't tell what was from what. A lot of the lived experience people we talked to came to us and said, yeah, like I'm interested in this research because I'm in midlife. And I'm, because I've had an eating disorder for so long, I still don't know if I've been through it. I have no idea where I am in that journey. So it's a struggle. And there's lots more work to be done here. I think that in terms of symptoms, there's no sort of pattern. I think what we've learned from reviewing literature and talking to people is that everyone's experience is so incredibly different. Mm-hmm. People, you know, with long-standing eating disorders could potentially experience new menopausal symptoms, or they could just experience symptoms that they've had for decades being heightened and struggling with that instead. Or, you know, there's people who could have onset of a new eating disorder during menopause. So there's no right and wrong here. Everyone was so diverse in what happened in their experience. But yeah, I suppose from making the diagrams for our educational resource and that, and really trying to look at the research and compare what symptoms can occur from eating disorders versus menopause, it really confirmed that there is so much overlap between the two. Like, you know, the common psychological symptoms of menopause that were coming up were things like low mood, anxiety, disturbed sleep, lessened sexual desire, all commonly seen across almost all types of eating disorders too. There was things like, you know, accelerated bone loss is a significant impact of menopause. Because similar hormonal changes are going on, it's also seen across multiple eating disorders. Things like fatigue, insulin resistance, increases in cholesterol. The list goes on, I suppose, of menopausal symptoms that are also commonly seen across eating disorders, both within and, you know, beyond and before menopause. And so yeah, that's not to say, I said quite a lot of symptoms, not to say everyone's going to experience all of them, but there is certainly lots of similarity in what people have experienced across the two, and that overlap with menopausal symptoms is not limited to certain types of eating disorders as well. We are seeing some sort of overlap with all types of eating disorders, which really aligned with that unanimous confusion being reported by women with lived experience that we've been working with. So yeah, unfortunately there's no nice and easy answer right now on how to differentiate between the symptoms of the two. But for people with, say, like severe and enduring eating disorders, who, you know, it can be really difficult to tell when and if menopause has even been reached because of that overlap. For people in that situation, things like a blood test are going to be the best help, but it can be hard to help on your own. So we absolutely advocate for people seeking professional help.
Yeah. Thank you so much for explaining that. And I think it's fascinating that the symptoms have such a big overlap. I think, you know, that it's brilliant that you guys are doing research into this and continue to do so, because it sounds like there's quite a few unanswered questions in terms of, you know, why there's so many overlaps, and then also, you know, how to help people further. And I guess, I don't know whether this is like devil's advocate or what you would call it, but my kind of, when you were saying that then, was like, okay, I'm a however old lady and I've had prior history of an eating disorder, and I'm getting to the age of having, you know, potentially going through the menopause symptoms or things are happening. I cannot not go back to my eating disorder because they're so similar. Like, I feel like I'm just going to automatically go back into those behaviours. Do you think from like the talks that you had with people with lived experience, is it the case that, and I know you said that everybody will be different, but do you think it's a really vulnerable time for people, and is there a way to avoid going back into those eating disorder behaviors, or is it kind of...
Great question, Hannah, and I think this is very much a prevention type question. I think, like, even with women as young as yourself, because you're looking very youthful,
I look like an 18-year-old and I'm actually 27, sometimes great, but when you want to go and buy yourself a bottle of wine and you haven't got your ID, and then they're like, oh, can you see some ID, please? I'm like, oh my God, I'm literally 27. I know.
That's, you know, they're just trying to keep you safe and not drinking too much alcohol, clearly. It's a public, service. So I think something that really came through in our research was women going, I wish we knew this information earlier. So women your age and younger, Hannah, going, okay, so I'm experiencing this eating disorder now, working towards recovery, and, you know, props to everyone working towards recovery and hopefully reaching it. But yes, there is this critical risk period again, and it's about putting measures in place when you know you're getting around it, so that your care team already kind of knows. So as you mentioned, some women are like, yes, this feels exactly like being a teenager. Here we go, eating disorder again. I need to control these changes in my body. It's still not too late to reach out for help. Obviously, like, early intervention is great, but prevention is best. So that was another reason for us doing this resource. We involved women who were premenopausal, in fact, because they were interested. But I don't think there's any time that's too early to start talking about this. And I think a really interesting comment that some of the women made was, look, there's so much education about puberty, but what about the other end of the spectrum, kind of the reverse puberty, which I quite enjoyed them talking about. You know, there's a start of our reproductive life and there's an end. We need to be talking about the end just as we talk about the start. And I think it just means that, I suppose, eating disorder treatment, it really helps to have your care team on hand, even if you're not seeing them that often. I suppose other risk periods are pregnancy, if people choose to become pregnant. So there are, you know, certain aspects in life that we know that we'll probably need extra support because of our eating disorder history.
And I think it's kind of similar to what we've already said for menopause, in terms of your mood and your changing body and your identity. And, you know, you've gone from potentially, you know, just living life, doing what you want to do, and then all of a sudden there's somebody else that you have to consider, which I think, you know, is a massive change that is sometimes, you know, you're meant to just embrace this situation, like, oh my God, I've got a new thing in my life and it's amazing, and I've like given birth to this child, which is obviously fantastic, but it can bring up lots of different questions about your identity and the person that you are, very similar to menopause. And I wanted to ask you a bit more. So obviously, you know, it's great if you've got a care team around you that kind of understand menopause and also understand eating disorders. But I wondered if in your research there was anything that stood out to you particularly about what eating disorder professionals can do to support women going through the menopause. I don't know what it's like in Australia, but I think it's probably more common in the UK for people to go to see their GP for menopause support. I don't think have like specific professionals unless you go private. I don't think that you'd get like a menopause specialist on the NHS or things like that. It would definitely be something more that you'd have to go for a private service. But I wonder, particularly in eating disorder treatment, what eating disorder professionals can do or where they could maybe learn more to be able to support patients that are going through the menopause.
Oh, Hannah, you're ticking off our next research projects beautifully there. You're all over it. So we did actually, because of the women involved in our research, we did have a section for health professionals. But obviously we plan to expand that massively. And just like in the UK, people are going generally to their GPs as a first port of call for menopause support. And those experiences are so varied. Unfortunately, in our research, we found a lot of bad or not ideal health professional experiences when people were seeking support for perimenopause, menopause. And that was very sad to hear, but obviously has engendered us to want to do better. Menopause care should be standard care for any GP. It's not specialist. It's something that every health professional should have at least some understanding of, and I suppose that's where we're headed next. Just in terms of the intersection with eating disorders, we know that that is, I suppose, a little bit more specialised, but again, if we at least tell health professionals to have a sort of compassionate, empathetic approach, don't be so blinkered about someone who has a long-standing eating disorder. Unfortunately, that does happen. We do actually need to listen if people are saying, hey, something is different is going on for me in my body. It's not just all the eating disorder. So even if we taught that much, just that compassionate, empathic listening, doing blood tests, if the person asks for it, going, hey, you know, this might be my only way to understand if I've been through menopause or not, even those little things will make a huge difference to these women we found. It doesn't need to be a whole system change. It is just small things.
And just on the note of blood tests, it might not be easy to just say, oh, it's that. But is there something particular in a blood test that shows up to say, like, you've gone through the menopause? Is it that clear cut?
So with people with eating disorders, it can be helpful. Unfortunately, we wish there was just some simple blood test for people to know where they are in menopause. There isn't. So mm-hmm. I suppose in that way, people with eating disorders are maybe a little bit luckier that their blood test can be a bit more informative. But yes, I think if your GP does push back on that, that's kind of understandable. And even with people with eating disorders, sometimes the blood test doesn't tell us everything. But I mean, what does it hurt to have a blood test done anyway, just to check on overall health? So I suppose we're still working out those markers for the different mm-hmm. stages of menopause. We sort of end up doing a mixture of blood testing, questionnaires, health history to try and ascertain where women are, and we still don't get it right all of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's got to be some perk to having an eating disorder, hasn't there? So if it means you can detect whether you've been through menopause, then that's great. But no, I think it's fantastic, you know, that you guys are doing that research, because if there is a way to, you know, say, okay, we've been through it now, because I think that's definitely something for my mum that's been really difficult. It's like, I just don't know when this is going to end or whether it has ended now or whether it's still ongoing. And then just, to, I guess, to finish us off, something I wanted to ask about, because obviously this is relevant to me, but as somebody supporting somebody going through the menopause, what would be like your best advice? Because I think I will put my hands up and say, before we realised that my mum was going through the menopause, I was like, what the hell has happened? Like, why is she forgetting everything? Like, this is so annoying. Like, she's forgetting everything. She's repeating herself. Like, her mood is on the floor. I was really worried. Like, holy shit, my mum's gone from being this like full of energy, full of life person, and now like never seen her so low. So I guess what would be your advice for loved one supporting somebody going through the menopause, in both the sense of, like, you know, having compassion for those emotional changes, but also supporting somebody if they have had experience of an eating disorder before to not lean into those behaviours, to kind of navigate their way through the menopause.
Thanks, Han. I'm going to let Alicia answer that one and then I'll add a little bit at the end, but I know she's all across this.
Thanks, Gemma. Yeah, it's an important question too, because, I mean, it has such a big impact on not only the person going through it, right, but also their families and their friends and other supporters too. So important that in our educational package as well, we have also dedicated a whole chapter to support networks with a range of tips and resources to help them too, because, yeah, we do recognise that it has a widespread impact there. In terms of tips or, you know, supporting someone through it, a big thing that loved ones can do is firstly just learn about menopause, learn about eating disorders, learn about the experience of them together by using things like the resource that we've created, listen to your loved one's personal experience if they're open to sharing. From us hearing the stories of people with lived experience, not all, but many of them did report things like not feeling like they could talk to their loved ones, or feeling like their loved ones thought they were crazy and they wouldn't understand what they were going through. So I think step one is really learning about the process and the challenges they're facing. That's going to help them feel supported and also help you to, like you were saying, approach them with compassion and empathy. And yeah, of course, like if you're supporting someone experiencing an eating disorder during menopause, I suppose it's not so much you pushing them to do certain behaviours and things like that, but it'd be great for you to encourage them to explore support options and professional help. Because at the end of the day, a big tip is, you know, it's not your job to treat them. You're there as a support person. You're there to love them. But you're not a professional and you don't have to step into that role. You got to, you know, continue to take care of yourself and make time for yourself too. And I suppose, yeah, keep that role as, you know, I love you and we're family or we're friends, and keep the relationship about things, you know, other than eating disorders and menopause. Don't make it the focus. You're not there to treat them. They are, you know, still your family member or your friend, and treat them as such. And yeah.
Yeah, I really like that. And it's, again, it's so interesting how, you know, the tips that I would give people if their loved one is going through an eating disorder, it's also very similar in terms of, you know, when someone's going through the menopause, because ultimately it's probably something that you don't know loads about, and therefore educating yourself, I think, can be really, really helpful, and just providing a space to have that open dialogue about what somebody's going through, because it can be a very difficult time with, like, emotions, but also, you know, psychological impact and the way that your body's changing and maybe the things that you can't do now. And I think being able to have that open space of, like, oh, you know, I can't actually do X now, and that makes me feel this way, but rather than kind of being like, oh, well, that's silly, don't be upset by that, you know, really having compassion for somebody. And I think something as well that I definitely saw was really helpful for my mum was, because she obviously had the support of myself and my dad, and that was really good, and my dad in particular has been brilliant in kind of supporting her through that and, you know, giving her ongoing love and, you know, kind of regardless of what's going on. But there is something really powerful about people going through a similar thing to you and having that connection. So I know that my mum joined quite a lot of, like, online forums to have open discussions of, like, oh my God, I'm experiencing this thing. Has anyone else been through this? Because I think sometimes Googling symptoms can be your worst enemy, but it feels like the only kind of thing to do. So to have that space to chat to other people about their experiences, but also, you know, if you have friends that are of a similar age to you, they might have been through the menopause, they might not have yet be at the menopause, but I think that, you know, just chatting to your friends about it as well, about those shared experiences, can sometimes be helpful. I know that my mum had conversations with her mum and her aunt, and they were both just like, I didn't even know Sarah was going through menopause, just breeze through it. And my mum's there, like, not sleeping, hot flushes, absolutely destroying her life, like, her mood's on the floor. She's like, yeah, did not need to hear that right now. But equally, she has friends that are going through it, and they've, you know, really been supportive of each other. And kind of taken, you know, I'm not saying that people that when they're going through the menopause are crazy in the slightest, because, you know, it's something that affects your brain and everything like that. But I think at the time you can feel crazy. So to have other people be like, oh yeah, I did that too. Like that's completely normal. I think can be really helpful to find that supportive space.
Absolutely agreed, Han. And I think that was what you're saying was a huge part of our resource development, just having little videos of women sharing their experiences, as you said, making people not feel so alone, because mm-hmm. it can be very isolating if you're the only one in the house going through menopause. It's pretty fun person to be. So that was that was a huge element, that lived experience input, because I mean, who cares what some crusty old health professionals have to say? They really want to hear what other women have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think sometimes you can go to your crusty old professional. Even my mum was saying that even she went to the doctor to see her GP, who was openly like, I'm going through the menopause, and still was like, you know, oh, let's just sort this out for you. My mum was like, this is very odd to say that you're also going through this. But I think having that support and things like our online forums are really good, because if you don't have people around you that are going through similar things, there are so many women that are going through similar things to you. So
absolutely,
there will be
people
out there.
Exactly, your entire generation.
Yeah, literally, yeah. Thank you so much for joining me. It's honestly been such a pleasure to speak to you both. Where can people go to find out more about, because I know that your research is ongoing, but also just to keep updated with any other research that you both do?
Thank you so much, Han, for that opportunity. So they can go to my staff page if they like, because all of the links to all of our resources are there. So just Google Gemma Sharp and Monash University. But the actual resource is on Eating Disorders Victoria e-learning hub. But again, you can just Google Eating Disorders Victoria and menopause and you will find our resource. So just a bit of Googling. Of course, people are welcome to contact me directly. I always enjoy getting contacted by people after they've listened to our podcast and things like that. So, yes, more than happy to direct people. But, yeah, basically just my page or Eating Disorders Victoria e-learning hub, you'll find it.
Well, I'll pop that in the show notes so that people have super easy access to that.
Thank you. Brilliant.
So you don't want to make that more difficult, but thank you both so much. It's been lovely to chat to you. And I still can't get over the fact that when we came onto the podcast, you were like, oh, it's been such a long day. And I'm like, I've been awake for 10 minutes.
No, that's, you know, welcome to the future, Han. It's great here on the 27th of June.
Yes. So,
no, I just had a few meetings today, that's all. I hope your mum listens to this podcast. She got so many shout-outs. I think she's going to love it.
Yeah, well, she is an avid fan and she does get a lot of shout-outs in the podcast because we are so close. So, yeah, but I know that she's very passionate about sharing her experience, so I thought that I'd bring that as well. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Han. It's been great.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.